I want to thank the organizers, deeply thank the organizers for the invitation to be here. So as you'll see in the second part of the talk, I actually don't come from a background in combinatorics. So I've been trying to read the literature on this sort of stuff, and especially the workshop part just made that, it just opened doors for me. So I'm really thankful for that. And so what I want to do in this talk is tell you two stories that have the same ending. So for the first story, I'm going to be talking about something on which I'm extremely non-expert, so I came here to learn about this sort of stuff, and if you have questions, you know, there are plenty of experts in the audience who know much more than I do. But I want to tell you a story in quantum cohomology, and I'll tell you a very narrow slice of this story, and then I'll switch to something that seems completely different and may seem to come completely out of the blue. However, there's the same combinatorial rule that will be coming in at the end that governs the answer to that story. So my hope is that this is not a fluke, and I have a lot of unsupported intuition to make me believe that this is actually not a fluke, that these things that these stories should have the same ending. But I'm doubly grateful for the invitation to be here, because I get to go fishing in an audience that's so expert. So I'm really going to be fishing, is the short version of that introduction to this talk. So I'm going to need some notation to start. It'll be the standard batch of notation, and we saw it last week in both Mark's and Thomas's talks, but I'll just remind you in case you're not comfortable. So in general, I think G will be a simply connected, semi-simple algebraic group. So what I'm going to do when I set up this notation is I'm going to sort of have two columns. So I'll tell you what the notation is explicitly for GLN, so that if you don't, if you're not friendly with root systems, you can always just think in this, in these terms. B will be a Borel subgroup. So in the case of GLN, you can just think of the subgroup of upper triangular matrices, and T will be a split maximal torus. So on the GLN side, then, what you're looking at is diagonal matrices. And I know this board, this gets in the way, so I may not write very much on that board at all. Okay, so let's see, what else do I need? Okay, so this data will actually fix for me a set of simple roots, which I'll enumerate by I. So, and then dually a set of simple coroots. So in general, I'll just let I run from 1 to R. So on the GLN side, then, this is exactly both of, actually, both sets correspond to the following set. So I equals 1 up to n minus 1. So these are the standard basis vectors, these EI. Okay, and then I'll denote by R and R check the corresponding root and co-root lattices. So what these guys are is just, actually this is general, but if you want to think of these explicitly, you're just taking the z-span of the simple roots and co-roots. At one point in the talk, I'll actually need this factor rho that commonly pops up in these sorts of games. So what it is then a half times the sum of the positive roots. So if you don't know what positive roots are, then then you can think about them. Well, this isn't going to make sense quite yet until I get to the rest of the meditation, but you can think about them as somehow coming from reflections in on the in the symmetric group. And so, but explicitly, if you want to compute this in the GLN case, then what you're going to get is half times the sum of a bunch of differences that look like this, except there will be a few more that you get to include. So EI minus EJ, and here I want the sum to run over the case when I is less than J. Okay. So these simple roots correspond in a natural way to a set of simple reflections, and these simple reflections act on both of these lattices here in the following way. So I'll just tell you how you act on the root lattice, for example. So if lambda is a root, then lambda gets mapped to lambda minus lambda alpha I check times alpha I. So this is the, this is an inner product here, which on the GLN side, you can just think about it as the usual dot product of vectors in Zn. Did I? Wait, I forgot on. Oh, good point. Yeah, thanks. You probably could have guessed. Thanks. Okay, so what do these simple reflections look like then on the GLN side? They're just the transpositions that interchange the I and I plus first letters. And then W in general is the finite vowel group associated to this picture, and you can think about it as being generated then by these S alpha I's. We've seen these generators and their relations a gazillion times already last week, so I won't write the relations, but there are the usual set of relations. There's some relations, and often I'll be lazy and drop the alpha from the picture. So so on the GLN side, then, this is just a symmetric group on n letters. There's a length function, which I'll denote in the usual way by L, and this is a function from W to the positive integers. And what it does, we've also seen this last week. So if you write an element in the symmetric group as a product of simple reflections or as a product of these transpositions in the minimal way, so when K is minimal, then we say that the length of W is K. And I need just one more piece of notation, so it perfectly fits on this board of sheer horror that begins any talk related secretly to representation theory. So W0 then will be for me the longest element in W. And so if you want to think about the symmetric group picture, the GLN picture, then this is just going to be it's going to be the element that exchanges 1 and n to an n minus 1, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll write its window. It's just easier that way. Okay, so this is W naught. Okay, so you've survived notation section, and now I get to tell you about, well, I get to tell you a very narrow slice of what I know about quantum cohomology. So here it goes. Okay, so what's the deal? Okay, so there's a notion of so G mod B is going to be a projective algebraic variety, and you can think about its cohomology. I think everywhere it's taken with respect to the integers. And this is going to be what kind of object is it? It's a free Z module, and it's generated by a special set of classes, which I'll denote by sigma sub w. So these classes are indexed by elements in the finite vowel group, or permutations if you'd like, and these are the Schubert classes. And the terminology is meant to bring to mind Schubert varieties, but I won't really get into the guts of much of this. I just want to sort of get right to one explicit formula, essentially. So now, what is quantum cohomology? Well, it's you're sort of taking usual cohomology and quantizing. So what I'm going to actually do is then tensor over Z with some sort of polynomial ring. So the polynomial ring that I'll use, I'll use Q as a shorthand to stand for R many commuting variables, and R here is the same R as many as you have simple reflections. And so if you want to make a quantum picture, then what you're going to do is you're going to study the following ring. So you look at usual cohomology and tensor over Z with this polynomial ring. And this is called the small quantum cohomology ring. So this is the small quantum cohomology ring. Okay. Now, it's been studied by just zoos of people. I mean, we're going to also see related theories even later today. So I want to actually just talk about one problem in trying to understand quantum cohomology. And so what happens is that actually the same phenomenon that occurred here with the Schubert classes generating the usual cohomology actually goes through here as well. So you still have these special classes enumerated by elements of the finite vowel group, and this forms a ZQ basis for quantum cohomology. And so what that means is that you're going to be interested in expanding products of the following form. So quantum multiplication, I'll denote with a star as opposed to a dot, which is, I think, the usual cohomology notation. So if I want to take two Schubert classes and multiply them, then I want to figure out how that expands in terms of other Schubert classes. Okay, so we'll have some other Schubert classes here. But because we are in the quantum world, we're also going to have a gazillion monomials in these QIs that are going to occur somehow in this product. So I'll denote those monomials by Q to the D. So here, Q to the D is just Q1 to the D1, blah, 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 times QR to the DR. So there are going to be a sum actually over that'll depend on D as well. And then there will be some coefficients. Okay, so these coefficients will depend on U and V, and they'll depend on W and D. And please correct me if I say anything that's, you know, if I leave anyone's name out in the history or if I need to be corrected, but my understanding of the state of things is that the positivity of these guys is known, and that's, I think, finally, let's see, I just told you G mod B, but actually there's a more general set up for any partial flag variety as well, and I think even that, in that case, the positivity of these guys is known, and it's due to the work of Thomas Lamb and Mark Shimizono. So what these are, I mean, these have a geometric meaning. That's sort of how you, I guess they got positivity in a different way, but these should be thought of geometrically as some sorts of Gromov-Whitman variants. Okay. So these are in the. Okay. So what I want to focus on, however, is not these coefficients, but rather these, the Qs. So the story that ends up having the same ending in this thread will be if you ask which monomials Q to the D occur in such a product, then there are partial answers to that story, and the combinatorics that governs that question, the answer to the question, is the same as the combinatorics I'll show you in the second half. So what happens then? Okay, let's see here. What I want to do now is say, well, let me tell you a little bit more, sort of one more step below the surface as far as expanding these kinds of quantum products is concerned, and that is to say that actually you can do a little bit better. So you don't actually have to let these Schubert classes run over all elements of the finite value group, but rather if you just know how a sigma and you put a simple reflection in there, how those multiply, then you can actually get the full picture. And so what I've just said is that these Schubert classes actually generate the quantum cohomology ring as a ZQ algebra. And so so what you actually have due to the work of Fulton and Woodward is a quantum Chevalier-Monk formula. So quantum Chevalier-Monk formula. And let me just say, for these products, so sigma, where you're taking classes then enumerated by simple reflections and then multiplying them by any other class. Okay. There's a formula for this. I would have to introduce more in notation to actually tell you explicitly what it is. So the next combinatorial object I'm going to introduce is actually motivated exactly from understanding the definition of this formula. And so I'll give you a sense of the spirit of what comes into these into this formula, and I hope that'll be satisfactory, at least for the moment. So let's see. So Posnikoff thought about this problem and introduced the following combinatorial object to help answer questions about which monomials occur in these quantum products. So let me tell you what that combinatorial object is. So this is the definition due to Posnikoff. Okay. So this is going to be a graph. My shorthand will be QBG. It's not the standard shorthand, but I like it for the purposes of talk. So it's a finite graph. It's a graph associated to the finite Weyl group, and its vertices are just going to be the elements of the finite Weyl group, and then its edges. Actually, it's going to be a directed weighted finite graph. Okay, so its edges. You draw an edge from W to W S alpha for alpha running over the positive roots if one of two things happens. So one thing that might cause you to draw an edge is that when you do this multiplication by this reflection, then the length goes up just by one. Okay. And something else that may happen is that the lakes may actually go down, but we don't want to just draw an edge whenever the length goes down. We want to draw an edge when the length goes down by a certain prescribed amount. And that prescribed amount is, well, one way of writing it, so that I didn't have to introduce even more notation, is to say that you subtract off this inner product. So remember, rho is the half sum of the positive roots. You form this inner product and then add 1. So if you prefer, so I'm not going to define this, but just for those of you who know root system stuff, so this inner product here, you can actually think of as also as twice the height of alpha check. Okay, so this inner product here. Okay, So I told you which edges to draw. We're going to do an example. So, and I'll also tell you how I think about it, especially in type A, which is where I get a lot of intuition for everything combinatorial. So, what are the weights? Let me write the weights over here, because you put one kind of weight on these types of edges and another kinds of weight on these types of edges. So if this is your kind of edge, then the weight I'll just write as a 0. And if the length of this new product satisfies this formula, then I will actually label the edge with the corresponding coroot. So the coroot that corresponds to this simple reflection. Okay. This is actually, if you know the papers that I'm referencing, this is not how you'll see the weights written in Posnikoff's work, but I want the pictures to really look literally the same at the end of the day. So let's do an example. Do I have room over there? I think I do. All right. Actually, before I do an example, I want to make a remark. We're probably all used to thinking about this kind of edge, actually. I mean, this just says you go up in Bruhat order and the length just went up by 1. So the way you can think about this is that your length, when you multiply by a reflection, this is not necessarily a simple reflection, this is any reflection. So when you multiply by that reflection, your length has increased as little as it possibly could have. Okay. And so the way that I like to think about this condition is that the length has decreased as much as it possibly could have given the constraints of the height. Okay. But if you think in the simply laced cases, then you don't even need that last parenthetical piece. It literally will just be the difference of the length of W and the length of S alpha. Okay, so that's, if you want to think concretely, which I always like to do, then in types A, D, or E, this second condition, the length of W minus this particular inner product plus 1, actually is the length of W minus the length of S alpha. Okay. All right, so now I've ruined my chances for having space on that board for an example, but that's okay. Let me do an example here so that I can keep it on the board. Okay. So what if W is the symmetric group on 3 letters? What does this graph end up looking like? Well, first, let me list the roots, the positive roots in this case. So the list of S alphas that we should consider are going to be the simple reflections. And then there's also another reflection, S1, S2, S1, because we'll need to know how to weight these edges. Let me write the corresponding coroot. So this will just be whatever alpha 1 check whatever it is. And then this will be alpha 2 check, and then this will be the actually the sum of alpha 1 and alpha 2. Okay. So here's how the graph is built. So I'm going to just draw the vertices are elements of this symmetric group. So I'm going to draw them in the usual way that we see this kind of thing drawn if we're drawing like Costa diagrams for Bruhal order. So this is actually equal. S1, S2, S1 is the longest guy in this case, and it's actually equal to S2, S1, S2, which we may need to think about in order to draw this graph. So, all right, so let me draw red and blue edges. So I'll draw blue edges of these first type. So what do I want to do? I want to draw a blue edge whenever the length increases, whenever going from here to here involves multiplying on the right by a simple reflection and the length goes up just by one. So that happens here, here, and that happens actually all the way going up. And then let's see, to get from here to here, I multiply by S1 and the length has gone up by one. And to get from here to here, I can multiply by S2, which is a reflection, and the length goes up just by one. And so that's it. Okay, so this is the usual Hasse diagram for the strong Bruhal order on this group. So what I actually want to do then is say if my edge was blue, it's a zero weight. So all of these blue edges are weighted zero. So in order not to clutter the diagram, let me not write in the zeros. Just understand that blue means the weight is zero. Okay, so what about these weirder guys? Well, let's think. So if I want to go, let's go down here first. So I can go from S1 down to the identity by multiplying by S1, and the length has decreased as much as possible because the length of S1 is just 1. Right? So I have downward edges, and similarly here and here, and the weights are alpha 1 check, alpha 2 check. And that also happens going all around again. So let's see. So this weight will be alpha 2 check. This weight will be alpha 1 check. And I'll get the opposite labeling of weights over here. And that's not all. I have one more edge. And that is this guy all the way down to the identity. So because I can multiply by this guy. It's a reflection, and my length has decreased as much as possible. It's decreased by the full length of that reflection. So this downward edge actually has the weight by where you weight by the sum of the two simple coroutes. So the downward edges are the weighted edges. And I'll leave their label. Are there any questions about that graph? Okay. Okay. Now, how does it relate to quantum cohomology? Let me tell you. All right. So let's see. So now what I want to do, okay, so what Postnikov did is, actually, let me go back. I promised to give you a sense of the spirit of this quantum Shevelin-Monk formula. So let me do that now. So basically, if you want to know the rule for how to multiply a Schubert class corresponding to a simple reflection times a random other Schubert class, then then this quantum Bruhat graph, or these rules, kind of tell you what to do. So so you'll have some sort of scalars out front, but the new Schubert class will be it'll be SI times V with no Q picked up, if you're in this case, and you will pick up a power of Q if you're in this case, where the length relates. Well, you'd be looking at V's, I guess, instead of W's, but these two rules sort of delineate when those products give you a power of Q and when they don't give you a power of Q. Okay, so that's a little bit about the quantum Chevalier-Monk formula. And so then what Posnikoff did was he was able to formulate an answer for which monomials Q to the D appear in a quantum product in terms of weighted paths, in terms of paths in the quantum Bruhat graph, and in terms of their weights. So let me tell you then how to find the weight of a path in this quantum Bruhat graph. So so just in general, if alpha check is the sum D1 alpha 1 check blah 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 plus DR alpha R check, so we're looking at some linear combination of these simple roots, then we write Q to the alpha check is just going to be the monomial prescribed with powers given by these coefficients. So it's going to be Q1 D to the 1 times blah 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 times QR D to the R. Okay? And so the weight of a path in the quantum Bruhat graph is then the product of Q to the weight of the corresponding edges. Okay. So I'll quickly do an example, because this isn't how it's written in the literature, but it'll be convenient for the analogy I want to make. So for example, if we want to look at the weight of the path in the quantum Bruhat graph that say goes from S1, S2 to S1 down to the identity, let's see, what color edges did I have? Actually, I had two pink edges, if that's the path I'm considering, and the first one is labeled by alpha 2 check, and the second one is labeled by alpha 1 check. So the weight of this path would then be, I'm looking at this rule, it would be Q1 to the 1 times Q2 to the 1. So this first edge tells me I pick up a factor of Q2, and what is it? It's just to the first power, because there's a coefficient of 1 here. And then this next edge tells me I pick up exactly a Q1, also to the first power. Okay. So you'll actually maybe notice then there's another way of using two edges in this quantum Bruhat graph to get from S1, S2 to the identity. So sometimes it can be cheaper to go up first and then down across a long arrow. So there's actually another path from S1, S2 to the identity, and namely going up to the long reflection and then all the way down to the identity. So, and what happens there is that I have a blue edge going to the longest element. And so that's going to contribute nothing to the weight, because what it's really going to contribute is a Q to the 0. All the coefficients are going to be 0. So it's really just contributing, you're writing things multiplicatively, it's just contributing a 1 to this monomial. So it's doing nothing. And then this long edge is actually doing both of these things at once, because it's labeled by this sum, and so these weights will agree. And that's not a coincidence. Okay. In fact, it's a theorem. That the weight of any two paths any two shortest paths between any two points should be the same. And there's more, so let me tell you a list of some, just some of the theorems related to this problem in quantum cohomology. Okay, so here's a theorem, and it's all this stuff is off. Okay, so here's just a list, and this is the list I'm going to mirror later. So this is a subset, a very proper subset of what's known in this story. But if you fix a U and a V in your finite file group, then here are some things that are known. So one, first, there exists a directed path in the quantum Bruha graph of W from U, U to V. Okay? So you can get anywhere from anywhere in the quantum Bruha graph. There will always be a path between any two given elements. Second is the thing I just spoiled with this example, and that is that all shortest paths from U to V have the same weight. Where you compute weight as I explained, and so that therefore will define this weight on any shortest path between two given elements to be the following monomial. We'll write it as Q D min from U to V. Okay, so there will be a unique such weight. And then, why is this unique such weight interesting? It's interesting because it gives you the smallest monomial occurring in any quantum product for a Schubert class associated to these two elements. So what do I mean? I mean that Q to the D min from U to V, it's not U to V. It's actually, this is why I needed the longest element. So there's actually a little normalization that happens here. So Q D min of not U to the V, but you actually look at paths from U to the longest element times C, but that's harmless, equals the unique minimal monomial occurring in the quantum product sigma U star sigma V. Okay. So it's not a priori obvious that there should be a unique minimal monomial. In fact, the first results of this nature appeared in the work of Fulton and Woodward, and what they did is they gave a description for the set of minimal monomials occurring in any quantum product, and it turns out that set has one element, but anyway, so it's not a priori obvious that there should be a unique such guy. Okay, so this is the story I wanted to tell on the quantum cohomology side. So now let me totally switch gears. And tell you a seemingly unrelated story that I hope is actually really related for some sort of geometric reason. Okay, so we're here at a conference on affine Schubert calculus. So nowhere did anything affine appear. Of course, if you know the work of Thomas Lamm and Mark Shimazono, you'll know that there is a relationship between this quantum cohomology and homology of the affine Grassmannian. So now I'm going to show you where I come from, and I also come from an affine context. So let me tell you which affine context Okay. So I hope that the first part being friendly, I won't alienate myself too much by saying that my preferred field of Laurent series is actually over an algebraic closure of a finite field. So elements in this field will be power series. Laurent series in a single uniformizer, and we'll have the ring. This is a discretely valued field, and there's a ring of integers, which looks like just formal Laurent series. So we're not allowed here in this ring of integers to take negative powers of the uniformizer. There's a valuation map. I probably won't have time to relate the valuation map, so let me omit it at the moment. So in this context, then, there's also a Frobenius automorphism, which on coefficients, so over on FQ bar, it just raises all of those elements to the Q's power. Q is here a power of a prime. So you can extend that automorphism then to the entire field of Laurent series by just acting on coefficients. There's also an affine version of the Bruhat decomposition. So let me remind you of the ordinary Bruhat decomposition first, so that if you don't like the subgroups that I'm using, then you can just think about this as the proper analog of the Bruhat decomposition you will feel comfortable with. So let me just remind you that GLNC breaks up into a disjoint union of double cosets of this subgroup of upper triangular matrices, and these double cosets are just enumerated by finite vowel group elements. And so the affine analog then is, if you're looking at G, I probably want to cheat now. Yeah. So probably now for the rest of the talk, I'll specialize to GLN just so that the story is easier to tell. But know that there's a theory for any reductive group. So GLN with entries now in this Laurent series will break up into an analogous disjoint union. So what are the analogous objects? The analogous objects are the Iwahori subgroup plays the role of the upper triangulars, and then X will actually now not run over just the finite vowel group, but it'll run over the affine vowel group. Okay, so here, then, what do I have to tell you? Well, let me go to the next board. I should tell you what I and X are. So which one do we want to do first? So we've seen the affine vowel group already last week, so let me just do that one first. So there's a way to think about it as a semi-direct product, which is the way I usually want to think, of the finite vowel group and this co-root lattice. So if I have a finite vowel group element here and a lambda in the co-root lattice, then I can think of the corresponding element in the affine vowel group as W times T to the lambda. So remember, lambda you can think of just as some tuple of integers, really. In the GLN case. And so T to the lambda then is the diagonal element which just plops T to the lambda 1, T to the lambda 2, blah, 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 all the way down the diagonal. So I can think about this as a matrix as well, if I need to. So I can think about this as being really a subgroup of GLN over this field. And this is the affine vowel group. Okay, and then I is the Iwahori subgroup. Uh, Let me not give you the formal definition, but rather say in the case of SLN what it looks like. So you'll have units all along the diagonal, i.e. Laurent series, which have a constant term. Above the diagonal, you'll have anything with power of t 0 or greater. Below the diagonal, you're not allowed to have a constant term. Okay, so that's what this subgroup looks like in the case of SLN. Okay, so this is the affine context in which I'm working. So now I want to tell you the combinatorial problem that I think about in this context. Okay, so here's the question. Okay, so this is the part on maximal Newton polygons. Okay, so given a G in GLN over this field of Laurent series, there's a way which I'm going to just leave this map extremely squiggly. I'm happy to answer questions about it in person, I think is probably the best way. So this is some sort of Frobenius twisted characteristic polynomial, and from that Frobenius twisted characteristic polynomial, I can draw a combinatorial object called the Newton polygon associated to that group element. Okay, so and then I can study this poset. I'm going to actually give you some idea about what kinds of objects these are in just a second. So I can study the poset of all the Newton polygons that occur for as I let my group element range over all elements in G. And so here's the problem, the specific problem that I've been looking at for a long time, is to fix an X in the affine vowel group and instead study the poset, which I'll denote by NGX, and what it is it's the set of all Newton polygons, so some sort of combinatorial objects that you can associate to group elements not just anywhere randomly in the group, but in one of these particular Iwahori cells. So G is now restricted to a particular Iwahori double coset. Okay. This is an extremely mysterious poset to date. So the things I know well, I know for low rank groups, and the particular problem that I've been looking at then is, so the spoiler is that in a one line proof, you can actually show that this poset has a unique maximal element. And I'd like to know what that is. All right, so. What the what? No, I'm gonna give you a cheap way of computing what a Newton polygon is in a special case, and then we'll see what kinds of objects these actually are, and it'll be clear what the order relation is. So let me do that now. Okay, so the current problem is to find the unique maximal element, say nu x in this poset. Okay, so now let me give you a flavor of what this poset actually contains. So here's a special case. when these two squiggly lines don't have to be squiggly. So if you're looking at an element y, and it's then actually in the affine vowel group itself, as opposed to in some double coset of the Iwahuri, so I'll write y as a v times t mu. So if this is an element of the affine vowel group, and let's say the order of v is k, then here's a cheap trick. I can tell you what the Newton polygon associated to that affine vowel group element is, and here's what it is. So what you do is you look at v, and you let it act on mu, and you let all of its powers act on mu, and then you sum over the result, and you take the average, okay? And then this may or may not, so this is going to be then some other object looking like a tuple of possibly rational numbers. It could be an n-tuple of integers, but possibly rational numbers. And it may or may not actually be dominant, i.e. it may not be written in decreasing order. And so if it's not, I want to make it dominant. Okay. So here's an example. So y is equal to S1. This is just going to be an element in the affine vowel group associated to SL3. So S1 times t to the minus 2, 0, 2. Then the Newton polygon of y is going to be a half times, and then I do this, so this guy has order 2, so I'll have two things in the orbit. It'll be 0, minus 2, 2, and I'll add that to what I get when I do v times v squared, which is just going to be the identity, so I get mu back, minus 2, 0, 2, and then I make it dominant. So here's the explicit formula, what it gives me, and then if you work that out, it turns out what you get is 2 minus 1 minus 1. So what kind of object is this? It'll actually live in the co-root, well, it'll live in the dominant portion of the co-root lattice. But, okay, this one just happens to be integral, but you could imagine doing some averaging where you smear around the orbit, and then the averaging effect will give you something actually rational. So this is the space in which it actually lives. And so order is dominance order, if you think this way. You can also actually draw a polygon. So where I think about these numbers as recording slopes. So I draw a polygon starting at the origin, and then I draw a segment with slope 2, and then I draw another segment with slope 1, and then another segment with, minus 1, and then another segment with slope minus 1. So this is my Newton polygon. I mean, you can associate a polygon to the picture. Okay, so here is... here's the algorithm, or here's an algorithm for computing. It's containment, except containment with the restriction that the bottom edge needs to be shared. So these two vertices, you can't compare two polygons unless these vertices are the same, and then you just do containment. So here's a theorem of Eva Fichman, which got me interested in this problem in the first place. So she actually gives an explicit formula for this maximal Newton polygon. So what do? You look at the set of all Newton polygons of y, where y is an affine vowel group element, and y is less than or equal to, I'm fixing an x always in this problem. So I'm looking at all the guys less than or equal to x, and this is in Bruha order. It's Bruha order on the affine vowel group. So I look at that set of guys related to X in the affine Bruja order. I compute their Newton polygons, which I can use this cheat trick to do. And then I take the max, and this is then with respect to dominance order. Okay. Now, so what I've tried to do, so I think this formula hides a lot. So in particular, what I suspected for a long time is that there should be a nice closed root theoretic formula, a prescription involving the translation part and the finite part of X, a combinatorial rule you can just write down for this guy. And so that's actually the theorem. And it's not obvious, by the way, it's not obvious that this was going to work out well for me. So, for example, it's not obvious by this formula that there should be some sort of formula that's constant on bile chambers and with respect to the finite part. So here's okay. So this is just going to be a little parenthetical thing I have to throw in to be completely precise. So if I normalize correctly, whatever that means, so maybe I have to make a weird choice, like work with the opposite Borel instead or something like that, then here's the result. For X equal to a WT, now I want to write it as V lambda minus. So this is an element in the affine vial group. And now what I want to do is actually isolate the vial chamber in which the alcove associated to this guy lies. So what I want to do is, so this will start out as a lambda, and its entries will be in whatever order, not increasing, not decreasing. But there will be a unique, well, as long as you're regular, there will be a unique finite vial group element by which you can multiply that lambda to get into the anti-dominant vial chamber. And that's what I mean by this V. So this is it's just a technical thing, but it's a way to isolate what vial chamber you're in. So for lambda minus anti-dominant and I do have some sort of super regularity condition, which you'll see also in the work of Thomas and Mark. The spirit of this super regularity condition is that the alcove associated to this affine vial group element isn't too close to the walls of any vial chamber. So another way to think about it, and this is actually kind of the right way to think about it with respect to this problem, is that you can go on an alcove walk and hit a translation, a pure translation element, before leaving the vial chamber you were in. Okay, so I can say more to experts about that if you'd like. So here's the formula then. Nu x is equal to, you take the lambda that you started with, you make it dominant, and then I'm going to subtract off exactly d min of w v v. Okay, so just remember, this is the same d-min that appears there. It's just, you know, a different pair of elements. Fine, that's d-min of uv. Here I'm looking at paths in the quantum Bruja graph from the element w times v to v, and then I want to look at all of the weights. So I'm adding this, I'm contributing a zero to this difference if my weight, my edge is a blue weight, and otherwise I'm subtracting off some sum of simple coroots. So the corollary of this theorem actually is basically that I can recover all of this information because, for example, I'm hiding in the translation between this theorem and this theorem, I'm hiding a lot, but what I know a priori is that there will be a path. By the work of Thomas and Mark, there will be a path from whatever, the pair of elements I need to look at in the quantum Bruja graph. And moreover, because I know this maximal Newton polygon is unique, it has to be the case that the weight on any two shortest paths between two given elements is going to be the same. And so then I know that there will be a unique monomial. So far what I can recover is just a list of theorems that was already known, but I'm hoping that that there's actually some deeper geometric reason that these two problems should be related. And I'd be happy to take any questions. Yeah? Oh. I have no idea, but I'm sure there's someone who does. I actually don't know. Okay, maybe we should talk more. I'm sorry, I just the terminology for me on the quantum side is actually pretty, like that there was a connection between these two things is like a few months old for me. So. Aha, it's going to be a finite number. I have no idea what its cardinality is. I haven't actually been thinking of doing enumerative statistics like that. So the kinds of questions that are open that I have been thinking about, so it actually turns out, this is also promising for some sort of analogy with the quantum cohomology side, that there's not only a unique maximal element, but there's a unique minimal element. So on the quantum cohomology side, there's some sort of strange duality that tells you that there should be a relationship like that. And I know that there will be a unique maximal and minimal element. I wonder if it's if there's a rank function even on this poset. I wonder if it's a lattice. There's of course this guy sits inside as a subset of this larger. So this thing is infinite, right? If you let G range over all elements in the group, you get an infinite thing. So another interesting question would be for which x do you actually get a sub-interval of something, you know, a sub-interval of upstairs? And I know there are cases when you don't. So it's kind of like, it reminds me of these K-core business where you look at the Young lattice and then there are rows that just like disappear when you want to look at cores. Like, it reminds me of that kind of phenomenon. Like, I know that that forming this poset is sort of weird, like you lose layers you would expect to be there or something if you were to be naive. But that's another set of interesting questions, you know, the enumerative side. I hadn't thought about it at all, actually, sorry. Let's see here. This is the best I can do. So what this poset sort of sees is intersections of Iwahori double cosets and Frobenius twisted conjugacy classes in G. So that's an algebraic answer, but that's kind of the best I can do. And actually, that knowing that gets you to the applications, which are the reason I got started on this Newton polygon side in the first place, which is that this is exactly how an affine Deligne Lustig variety is defined. Sort of, you're looking at those intersections, Frobenius twisted conjugacy classes meeting these affine Bruhoff cells.
Thank you so much for
introducing everything. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, it was a good educational experience, right?
Thank you for, like,
Yeah. Oh. Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it was really wonderful.
I hope I'm not. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I hope there's some. It would be really cool if there's something really real here. I mean, there is like an Affine Grassmannian or Affine flag variety like hanging out in the background of the Newton polygon picture. So, I mean, maybe somehow like through several stages of dictionary. I don't know if there would be a reason to expect these things are related.
I mean, have you looked at like really special cases?
It's still coming through the back.
Oh my gosh.
Did you see those audience members?